Good afternoon. So, last time we were talking about various ways that malware could try to hide from analysis, some miscellaneous ways. We started by talking about so-called metamorphic viruses, and these were based on what we called mutation engines, which basically take machine code and produce new machine code. And the idea here was, rather than just having some part of our virus code that's encrypted and a generator for a decryptor, we would just have the whole piece of machine code be transformed into new machine code every time we want to make a new version. And this would make detection via something like signatures very difficult. Also, this meant that we could end up transforming application code. And so this gave us a very generic solution to, what if there's no space to put the jump to the malware code? We can modify existing executables using the same technique. And it seems like, pretty challenging to implement this mutation engine, and it probably is, but kind of the most confusing part is what we called relocation. That what do we do when we have jumps and other things in our machine code, and we want to make them do the same thing in the new machine code? And we learn that, one way of doing this is we can keep track of how big our original instructions were and how big our transformed instructions were. And using this, we could figure out, if this jump is going to, this instruction at, this many bytes before, we can count the instructions and count the new instruction sizes to figure out, that's now going to be a different number of bytes before, and we can write that new number in. Then we talked about, kind of a more, arguably advanced obfuscation technique, and the kind of thing we do not sort of on machine code, but on kind of our higher level code. And one of the things that we mentioned Tigris supports as an option. And this is to hide what our malware does by making it so the code is not machine code, but is code in some kind of interpreted language we made up. And so what we'll have is we'll have an interpreter. And that interpreter can be a little bit custom. And the idea of this is that, if you want to analyze that, now you need to make some tools to analyze not machine code that you already have, but some new language. And you probably, as an anti-malware author, can't just say, if it has an interpreter, something that goes through and sort of simulates something machine code-like, like, get rid of it, because this is how a lot of legitimate programs are going to work if they use language interpreters like Python or Lua. Then we talked about responses to kind of one of the more arguably obvious techniques for malware detection. So we mentioned self-replicating malware, like Vienna, like just look for executables to modify. And if we're doing that, we can set up traps for it, where there's an executable we know nothing should ever touch, and if we ever see it touched, we know we've detected the malware. And anti-malware authors, at least Jor, called this sacrificial goats. And malware often has heuristics to avoid falling into those traps. That it's going to check that, are the executables I'm infecting in a location that seems realistic? Are they a realistic size and things like that? And so this means that if you are an anti-malware author signing to set these traps, that's not just going to work automatically. Then we talked about kind of some anti-analysis and detection techniques that target kind of runtime analysis. So one thing that we often want to do with software to figure out what it's doing is run it in a debugger. And we learned that a bunch of our features of our debugger are things where the malware can kind of directly interfere with that. with breakpoints, we learned, well, breakpoints are often implemented by temporarily patching the machine code of the program, so malware that checks if its machine code change can kind of make breakpoints not work by, you know, having the malware not behave correctly when its machine code is modified. And with single stepping, you can often kind of query directly, is the processor in a mode where we're doing single stepping, is debugging on? This is things you can work around, but it's often some effort as a malware analysis analyst that you would have to deal with. And finally, we talked about kind of so-called rootkits, that malware that uses the same kind of tools that anti-malware software would use to, you know, intercept operations that programs are doing, to like access files, to access processes, not to detect malware, but to hide itself from anti-malware programs. You know, so one idea is like when anti-malware programs try to open up an executable file, you give them a clean version, one that doesn't have malware in it, even though when you run the executable file, you run the unclean version. And we mentioned that, you know, conceptually, if you do this quote-unquote right, this rootkit style malware can't really be detected at runtime, but often, you know, they might miss a few cases. So it's not impossible in practice to detect these a lot of the time, but kind of our best idea is to, you know, prevent them from getting this access in the first place, or detect it with the from some other system inspecting the code that's on disk or something. Okay. So that's a review of what we talked about last time. And for today, we're going to move on to talking a bit about exploits. And I'm going to start off by talking about a type of exploit I think is review, and kind of one mechanism that is both a way of countering that exploit and also another kind of reverse engineering technique, I think, is something I want you to be familiar with, though I don't think we'll be doing it in any assignments because the tools for it don't seem very stable. So the exploit technique I'm going to talk about is what we'll call command injection. So let's say I have a Python program which, you know, lets you get, you know, reports for something as PDFs. You know, so you go to a website, you type in a name, and you get a report that you can download as a PDF. And maybe I call some, you know, separate program called write report for to do this. And the way I do that is, you know, I just run a shell command here. And I just take my name in and put it here. And the problem here is that I can set the name so that when we run this command, the command we're running is actually write report for, and an empty string, then some malicious command from this untrusted input, something someone typed in a website, and then this bin true command with an empty string, and then output.pdf, and bin true will just always succeed, so this check call will say, yeah, everything's fine. Then there will probably be some problem with reading output.pdf, but at that point, it's too late. We've already run this malicious command. And this is something I've marked as I think this is review, because I think you've seen this before in Intro Cyber or possibly elsewhere, at least in the context of the same problem with SQL injection, that we have a command where we're inserting a string, and it turns out that that thing we're inserting doesn't stay as a string. And that's the same problem we had here. This name was intended to be a string in the command, but it turned out that we didn't enforce that it stayed as a string. So command injection is just the generalization of things like SQL injection. And I would say a whole lot of the things we're going to look at as exploits, the kind of more advanced ones, you know, are kind of the same idea, where we have some input that's meant to be used as one thing that ends up being interpreted as a different type. So we're going to talk about a bunch of memory vulnerabilities where we have buffer overflows. And we can kind of think of them as an example of the same problem, that the input's supposed to be part of this buffer that's like a string, but because of overflow or something like that, it ends up being interpreted in a completely different context where it's dangerous. So we have this idea that we have our input and it gets used in a way that input is not supposed to be used. And there's a generic kind of program analysis technique that can attack this and try to look at how is our input actually used. And there's an idea that's been around for a long time called dynamic taint tracking, where basically the idea is that when we take our input, we look at where the input goes as the program runs. And this is commonly called taint tracking. So we'll say that some values are tainted, and by default, using those values to compute other values will taint the resulting values. And this is, in fact, been implemented sometimes. So probably most prominently, the arguably mostly defunct programming language Perl, but used to be very popular, has this as a language feature. I'll show some examples of that, but it doesn't seem to have gotten wide adoption as a language feature. The other place that this idea has been used is that you can make an emulator where we do this tracking. We say that some values in registers or in memory are tainted, and we see where they get used to compute other things. And if we're thinking of analyzing malware, this can be really handy to know, oh, I know this malware ends up reading this thing from the network. Where does that go? This can tell you exactly that. So to start out, I'm going to give an example of how this looks in Perl. So here we have an example of our command injection vulnerability where I'm running a makedir command and I'm running it with a name that's supplied from the input and I'm appending dir to it. So kind of the intended use is this prompts me for enter name. I type something like foo and then this makes a directory called foo-dir. But what I can do if I'm malicious is I can type something like, foo semicolon, and some command I'd like to run that shouldn't run. But when we turn on taint tracking, what happens here is that Perl recognizes that this value is tainted, which means that this value, because it was computed from a tainted value, is tainted. And that means that this value, the string we're passing to system, the thing that runs a shell command, is also tainted. And therefore it says, oh, insecure dependency, you can't do this. And the idea that Perl used for, well, how do I actually make this possible when I want to actually create that directory, is that we have to do an explicit operation to filter out our input. And this operation as in a deliberate special case, this is going to say, extract sort of alphanumeric characters from name. This is going to mean that even though the original name is tainted, that this is now going to be untainted because we did this operation that, explicitly checks what the contents of Neymar. And this is, you know, you can think of, this is this kind of idea, this is a defense against all these attacks that, you know, rely on us getting input that's supposed to be interpreted in one way, but is used in a quote-unquote dangerous context. In this example, our dangerous context is running a command, like on the command line. We can imagine applying the same idea to, like, you know, having a SQL command, or, you know, as we'll see later, like jumping to a function and things like that. Now, we can apply the same idea as kind of a malware analysis technique. We can say, okay, let's, you know, run something in a virtual machine and use this taint tracking idea to say, you know, when it reads in the input of a file, that's going to be tainted, and let's see what things it outputs that are also marked as tainted. Or we can do the same for network packets and so on. And we can make this more sophisticated by, rather than just marking it as tainted, we can mark it as tainted from some input. And using this, we can, you know, say, oh, this value that was output to the file, it was computed from these packets. Now, what I'm doing, like, probably seems plausible if we're talking about kind of a high-level language like Perl, but, you know, if we want to do this for normal malware, we'd want to do this kind of at a lower level. And there are, in fact, have been tools in kind of the research domain, and I think theoretically in practice, though these tools don't seem very stable, which try to do this on a whole system way at the machine code slash assembly level. So two examples are panda.re, which I tried to get working for a demo, and it's not stable. It crashes. But, you know, it's an example of what you should do this, assuming it works for the authors. And Panorama is an example of an older system. And what we're doing at the assembly level is we have an emulator where, you know, whenever we, you know, do an operation, we say, oh, well, this is modifying memory at R8. We're going to have a table with a value for all of memory indicating, you know, where it's tainted from. And we're going to update that as we run this add instruction. And we can have the same idea for things stored on disk, for packets on the network, and basically for every single byte of data in our emulator or our virtual machine, we'll have, you know, information about what inputs is this tainted from. Is it tainted? And if so, maybe some extra information like, you know, this is tainted from input number one or input number two. So this is obviously going to slow things down a whole bunch, but it kind of gives us information about what happens with some malware that's running in a virtual machine, you know, that doesn't require us looking through a lot of assembly code and so on. Now, if you as a malware author are concerned about, you know, people doing this kind of analysis, there are things you can do to work around that. And to talk about that, let's, you know, go through what things, you know, we talked about our strategy is that we're going to track for every value in registers in memory, you know, is it tainted or not, and update that as we compute new values, you know, during like add instructions and move instructions. Given this idea, you know, which of these options do we think would be a viable way to kind of confuse that analysis? And I recommend pausing, working through this, and I'll go through my answers in a second. Okay, so I'll go through these options here. So one option here is A, timing the arithmetic operations to see if the machine is unusually slow. We mentioned that this is, you know, a general anti-emulation technique. We can work around this with a virtual clock. But, you know, that's going to be a challenge. For item B, computing the hash of the malware's machine code and comparing it to a known value, this is not going to be a problem because it's an emulator. That the emulator is going to be reading the machine code and kind of simulating what it should do. It's not going to modify it in a way where we can't read it back. So this, I would say, is not a problem for this taint tracking. Now, C, however, C is a real problem. And that's because what we were doing was we were looking at each instruction and saying, the input of this depends on the output. But if we think of how this is likely to compile, this is going to be move 1 into Y. And 1, the constant, isn't tainted. And we're just going to say, oh, therefore Y isn't tainted, even though there is a dependency from X to Y. So this is a way of fooling this analysis and making it say, unless we do some extra work to handle this case, that there's going to be a problem here. There's not going to be a problem here. That this is going to say, oh, this is not tainted. So this is going to fool this analysis where what we want to say is that, oh, X is tainted if Y is, meaning that if Y is based on some input we're interested in knowing what happens to it, so is X, this is going to make that be false. And on the other side, we have this idea in D, where here, what I've done is I've made it so that if we do our taint tracking, we're going to say, oh, X here was computed with Z. So where what's going to happen in case D is that we're going to mark X as tainted if Z is tainted. So if Z is some input, we'll think X depends on it, even though that's not really true. So there are these two ideas that if you want to defeat this kind of tracking, you can use this idea to sort of make things falsely not tainted. Sort of say not dependent on the input. And we can do D to make things falsely tainted, to make things dependent on the input, it's like Z is our input, when they're not really. And because this analysis is something sort of people analyzing malware like doing, or even analyzing software in general like doing, these exact transformations are things that Tigris supports doing, just to defeat this kind of taint tracking analysis. Okay, so that's on, defeating this checking. So as for what is this useful for? So I mentioned this idea that we can find out, where if we have some malware sample, we can find out what is it doing with its input, where is that going, And we can also use it for cases where we have vulnerabilities and say, how does this malicious input end up somewhere bad? We can figure out that happens, and we can also kind of trace back and look at what values are changed along the way to figure out what caused it to end up, say, for example, in a command. What was the path that went? And to give a concrete example of something people have done with this taint tracking idea, I have this paper from a bunch of places where they did use this taint tracking idea to answer the question of, okay, we have a smartphone and we have applications that, are taking data that's potentially sensitive, is that data leaking to the network? So they figured this out by doing this taint tracking idea on Android in this case, and on the Dalvik virtual machine. So most Android applications are written in something Java-esque. So there's a virtual machine. They modify that virtual machine to do this taint tracking. And use that to figure out, oh, there are applications which are sending out information, you know, to a server that's based on, you know, identifiers for the phone and so on. And they figure that out sort of automatically, you know, without, you know, needing to like carefully reverse engineer everything about the application. They just looked at, oh, this application got, say, your current location. Where did that value end up being used? Okay, so that's my brief foray into taint tracking, which, as I mentioned, so it's a really nice technique for figuring out where data goes in programs. And it turns out that, you know, with a lot of overhead, we can apply it kind of generically to programs to figure out where data goes. Though, if we're worried about some malware author trying to defeat this technique, there are these ideas they can use that will kind of break it. So, now for our next very big topic, which I expect to spend several lectures on, we're going to look at more interesting vulnerabilities than this command injection. And I promise we'll be talking about memory vulnerabilities. And we're going to talk about buffer overflows. And you've seen buffer overflows before. And kind of our general thought for buffer overflows is that, you know, we cause a program to write something past the end of the buffer, and that somehow causes different stuff to run. And we're going to talk about cases where it causes stuff that the attacker wrote to run. We're going to talk about why that's going to be a common thing and how that happens. And we're going to spend a ton of time on buffer overflow vulnerabilities in this class. And the big reason why is that for a very long time, this is by far the most common vulnerability in programs. Maybe this is a little less true today. As we're going to talk later, there's a lot of things that have been done in response to buffer overflows to make them happen less often and be less often something that results in arbitrary code execution. Also, talking about buffer overflows is going to help us talk about some other major memory management vulnerabilities, like use after free vulnerabilities, and how they can also result in arbitrary code execution. Now, we're going to get to sort of this idea that, oh, this buffer overflow is going to cause different code to run. Because if you like, you've looked at like really simple examples of buffer overflow, it's not obvious that this would happen. Like, it's clear that there's going to be some data near the buffer that the attacker can manipulate, but it's not obvious, like, why would this cause, you know, different code that's useful to the attacker to run? But we'll learn that kind of one of the reasons why buffer overflows were such a, you know, bad vulnerability for a long time is that it's really common for them to result in running code of the attacker's choice. And it's fairly easy for the attacker to make this happen consistently and without needing to do a lot of effort to customize their exploit to a particular application. And to talk about buffer overflows, we need to talk about, well, how are we getting, you know, some input that can overflow a buffer? And there's kind of two big contexts where that happens. So one example is that we have vulnerable servers, and probably the most prominent example of buffer overflows in this case were worms, so self-replicating programs that replicated by connecting to remote servers. And this, in fact, includes kind of the first well-documented self-replicating malware called the Morris worm, which replicated to mail servers by using a buffer overflow exploit, that the mail server would read an input, and this would exceed the size of a buffer, and that resulted in arbitrary code execution in a way we'll talk about later. And there's been later examples of that too. But probably a more pernicious way that this can be a problem is that a lot of code that parses files, like, you know, animations, PDFs, you know, JavaScript stuff, image viewers, you know, has issues where it needs to put things in buffers and it can mess up keeping the bounds of that buffer, and we can write outside the bounds of that. So these are cases where there's a way we can get people to, you know, run the buffer overflow by downloading a PDF that triggers this bug, or an image that triggers this bug, and so on. And this has been one of the places where there's been the most concern about these buffer overflow vulnerabilities. So let's talk about what a buffer overflow looks like. And I'll start with an example where we're not going to have arbitrary code execution, and then we'll go on to, like, how can we execute code with this? So here I have a buffer of 1,000 bytes, and I also have a variable called score. And what I'm doing is I'm reading using this function called getS into the buffer. And getS, you know, will be our, you know, example function you should never use for us, for overflows. You know, do not use it. But the reason it's an example for overflows is that it doesn't know how big, you know, if it goes out of bounds. It doesn't know how big the input buffer is, so it's just going to read however much it can, and if that doesn't fit in the buffer, it's going to go to the next thing in memory. So let's say that the way that our compiler lays things out here is that it puts our buffer first, and then it follows it up with the score variable, and it stores both of these on the stack, and then we have the return address for give quiz. So if we input, say, 103 characters into, you know, our terminal, then what's that going to do? Well, getS is going to put that in our buffer, going to put the first 100 characters, and then it's going to run out of room. And it doesn't know, you know, that the buffer only has space for 100 characters, so it's going to put the next character in the first byte of score, and then the first byte, next byte of score, and then the next, and that's going to put an old terminator. So if we input 103 A's, we end up modifying the score to have the value, if we remember a little endian, 616161 hex. And so this gives us a case where, you know, we can modify this score here in a way we're not supposed to be able to, that rather than just incrementing it by one when the answer matches, we can actually just set it to a value as we give our input. And I reset it to the value 0x616161, but depending on what we put in these last three characters, that could have been any sort of value. And something you'll notice that we'll talk about more later is that we also, after this score variable, we have this return address for give quiz. And that sure seems like it's in a very precarious situation. And we're going to talk about taking advantage of that later, and that's what's going to give rise to our vulnerability, which allows arbitrary code execution, most easily in this case. Mm-hmm. But first, we should talk about, okay, we have this type of buffer overflow, and I was assuming to make this happen, we have a buffer right next to our score variable. How do we know that that happened? And to figure this out in practice, we're going to need to look at our actual kind of code to look at what's going on. So here I have an example where we have a buffer and an array of scores. And we want to know, where after the buffer is the array of scores. So this is where we're going to have to use our reverse engineering skills to figure that out. So the exercise that's on the slide is, we have our machine code here. Based on that, where is the, scores array relative to the buffer array? How are things laid out on the stack? And as a hint for figuring it out, what I would look at is I would say, okay, I know buffer is passed to getS. So that's going to be helpful for figuring out what the value of buffer is. And I know scores is assigned to after getAnswer. So I can say, greatAnswer, I should say. So I know that the return value of greatAnswer is used to modify scores. So I would recommend pausing and we can try to figure this out on your own. Okay, so I'll go over why I figured out the answer. So let's start with the address of buffer relative to the stack. So buffer is the first argument to getS. So this RDI here, this must be buffer. And this means that this is buffer, which means that this is buffer, which means that this is the address of buffer. So buffer is at RSP plus 8 once this function starts. Then we have to think about where is our scores array. And for the scores array, we know that this here is the scores of I equals, and this is, remember, RDI plus RBX times 4. So the times 4 part, that's the I indexing. So RBX is I. And RDI must be the value of the address of the scores array. And RDI is set to RSP plus 24. And so that means that the beginning of the buffer and the beginning of the scores array are 24 minus 8 bytes apart. So this is, going to be RSP plus 24 minus RSP plus 8, or 24 minus 8, which is hopefully 16. Okay, so given that we know that, let's talk about, what happens if we input a bunch of copies of the character 1? What's the value of scores of 0? And as a hint to think about this, remember that we're storing the characters in ASCII. And we know that our stack layout is that we have our buffer followed by our scores. Okay, so to think about this, we need to know, what is the character one going to look like? Well, we're going to it's going to be the character one is equal to 0x31 if we look up in an ASCII table. And this means our buffer is going to have a bunch of 31s. And because we have 50 copies, we have the first 16 are here, and then the next 50 minus 16 are at the beginning of the scores array. And so we end up having our scores of 0 and scores of 1 and scores of 2, not all scores, but the first several elements being set to 0x31313131. Okay, so that's kind of our basic overflow case. But all we've done here is we've modified the values of data that's stored near our buffer. And in some specific programs, like these examples, that's really useful. We can modify things that's probably, you know, how an attacker would want to attack these programs, like modifying our grades in this example. But, you know, this is kind of very program specific and doesn't let us run arbitrary code, which I promised would be possible. So our next big topic, we're going to talk about stack smashing. And this is a very common buffer overflow pattern where we can apply this pattern to run code based on almost any buffer overflow, well, at the time it was discovered, on the stack. So at the time this was discovered, this worked for pretty much any buffer on the stack. We have this one way where we can end up executing arbitrary code. And the preview is the way this is going to work is that we're going to overwrite this return address that's going to be somewhere after our buffer. That's the trick, that there's almost always a return address there. You know, we don't need to have the data we want to overwrite there. We just need to have the return address be there. And, well, the way our stack works, it's kind of always there. And this idea of stack smashing was originally kind of published about in the so-called non-traditional literature. And that's also where the name comes from. So ALF1, also known as Elias Levy, wrote this paper for talking about how to perform this attack on typical systems in 1996. Called Smashing the Stack for Fun and Profit. That's also where the name comes from. So this is what we'll talk about next time, but to give an example, here's our kind of example of vulnerable code for this case. That here I have a string that's on the stack, and I read into this buffer that is only 100 characters long. And if I input a very large string, what ends up happening is that it segfaults because I overwrote the return address and it tries to jump somewhere crazy and crashes. But instead of it trying to jump somewhere crazy, we can arrange for it to jump somewhere that is useful to the attacker. And next time we'll talk about how is that possible and how do we set that up. Okay, so that's all I have for today. So we'll review all of this next time and hopefully in person. See you then.